Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMCortho.
Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. Lawrence Garbo is a medical oncologist and hematologist at New York Oncology Hematology. He's board certified in internal medicine, hematology, and medical oncology. Dr. Garbo received both his undergraduate degree in biology as well as his medical degree from the University of Vermont and completed his residency and fellowship at Albany Medical College. In addition to treating patients, Dr. Garbo also chairs New York Oncology Hematology's Research Committee, where he oversees the region's largest clinical research trial operation. Over the past 20 years, it has played a pivotal role in FDA approval of 38 anti-cancer drugs. Gerianne Currier is also here with us today. She's manager of New York Oncology Hematology's clinical research. She oversees nearly 40 clinical research trials here in the Capital Region through the U.S. Oncology Network, the National Cancer Institute, the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and private pharmaceutical companies. To be part of today's conversation, you know where to get us, 1-800-348-2551. Again, write it down, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You could comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. But the one I like the best and the one you should do is email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Well, Doctor and Jerry, thank you so much for being with us today. This is really great. This is very important stuff. It really is, because in some cases, this can be life-saving, can it, Doctor?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Cancer is very treatable and often curable, more and more so as we move forward, with drugs that have less toxicity and are more targeted towards specific pathways in cell development.
Well, you know, Doctor, many of us are worried, not that about getting cancer, although we certainly do worry about that, but about finding it in time. You know, in other words, you know, if you don't get it in time, you're in trouble.
Well, certainly early detection is key. Obtaining good medical care, seeing your primary care physician regularly, paying attention to things that seem out of whack, and following up if there are what appear to be genetic or hereditary events in your family are very important. Also, avoiding toxins such as excess sun exposure, tobacco, et cetera.
I just saw a piece in the New York Times, I think it was yesterday, that indicated that Jewish women, who we had presupposed had to have people with a marker for breast cancer and other things, it turned out not to be so. Did you see that piece?
I didn't see that particular article, but we've always looked at Ashkenazi Jewish women to feel they have an increased risk of having the BRCA, BRCA mutations.
Sure. Well, anyway, and Jerry, exactly what do you do there?
Well, New York Oncology Hematology has been conducting clinical research trials in this area since 1976. I'm not sure that many people in the community are aware that we have access to trials here just the same as larger centers, Memorial Sloan Kettering, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. We collaborate
with those
centers.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but do you have all of them that they have? No, you have some.
Not all of them. We have some. Currently, we're open to 37 different clinical trials that encompass all the different diagnoses, in addition to radiation therapy, oncology trials. And so I manage that program. We have a dedicated staff of 13 that is made up of research nurses, regulatory coordinators, data coordinators, and I am currently managing that program. We enroll patients here locally.
So give us an example of a trial that you're having now.
We have several different trials, and as Dr. Garbo said, the push right now in clinical research is on targeted therapies, moving to treat patients and leaving their healthy tissue alone. So chemotherapy in the past, its goal is to kill every fast-growing cell you have. Unfortunately, it affects your healthy tissues too. So we have several studies right now that are around targeted therapies that target certain DNA mutations that your cancer may have undergone. And we can do pathology and histology testing to identify what those mutations or markers are. And there are now drugs that directly affect those targets. So your healthy cells and surrounding tissue can be left unharmed.
Now, Dr. Garbo, you're a hematologist, so you're looking through the microscope and now you can identify things we never knew you could before?
Actually, microscopic evaluation is not a lot different now than it was many years ago.
Okay.
The microscope for many years was the only way to diagnose cancer. Now we can find things going back further with genetic mutations, as Jerry Ann was just alluding to. But certainly, under the microscope, we can see tumors from solid organs or blood tumors. And that's a primary way of making the diagnosis.
So I tried to get Jerry Ann to give me a simple answer on this. Maybe you can help me with it, because I just want one example of a test you're doing now.
A
clinical trial.
Okay, so there's a pathway called PD-1 with a similar pathway, PD-L1. And we have multiple trials available looking at drugs that are active in that pathway. We have to send tissue out to be tested to see if they would be potentially sensitive.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you were setting me straight before when I needed setting straight, which is one of the things that's always given me trouble on a double-blind study, is that some people get the clinical drug you're looking at and some people don't. But you told me that there's another way of looking at that.
So on a double-blinded study, I think what we were talking about before was actually placebo.
Placebo, sure.
Okay, and so most trials...
A placebo, for those people who don't know it, is basically a sugar pill.
Okay, so the quote-unquote sugar pill is either given in combination with a standard therapy, so you get standard therapy with or without the sugar pill, so you're still getting a standard treatment for the particular cancer. Or if someone has very advanced disease and has been through all standard therapies and the only treatment option is supportive care, then we may consider supportive care versus the quote-unquote sugar pill.
Okay, let's take a first call. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Bill in wherever. Bill in New York. Okay, Bill, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Garbo, Dr. Jerry Ann. My friend has been diagnosed with lymphomatoid papillosis, and because it was kind of rare, like 1% of the population, it took a long time to diagnose, probably a year that we had noticed his skin lesions and before he started undergoing a chemo treatment. And I looked it up in some... recommend a two-prong approach, and I really don't know what that is, but it seems like his doctor is treating him with a single-prong approach, whatever that is, and I just want to know
a little bit more. Okay,
what
doctor.
Think of either of those and what kind of drug he should be on, and what is the chance that it will develop to the more complex lymphoma that is a 20% result of his current condition?
Okay, well, I think you've partially answered your own question. That's about a 20% progression to lymphoma. And as far as which treatment he should be on, it really depends on where he is in his disease, how extensive it is, and what other medical problems he may have.
He is a very healthy individual, 60 years old. He currently does a one-hour time trial, 20 miles an hour. So.
Okay, well, we obviously, Bill, what we can't do here is diagnose, you know, his particular issues, you know, because doctors have to examine him. So obviously, we have to just assume that it's something that needs particular diagnosis. Okay.
No recommendations for drugs beyond whatever his own doctor is.
I think if he's being seen by a medical oncologist or hematologist, he's getting appropriate advice, and he should continue to follow and be treated under that direction.
Right. Okay. He's currently taking 8 pills a day, and that sounds like something people do.
Again, I don't know what pills he's being given,
I really can't answer that.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yep, bye.
Okay, we'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery. Choose stmarys.com. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees. Offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. New York Oncology Hematology, for more than 30 years, providing comprehensive cancer care in your community, with locations in Albany, Latham, Troy, Rexford, Amsterdam, and Hudson, New York. NewYorkOncology.com. Old Songs Concerts, Voorheesville, New York, presenting Jim Malcolm on guitar and harmonica, singing his own and traditional Scottish songs, Saturday at 8 p.m., oldsongs.org. And the Unitarian Universalist Congregations, with locations in the Capital Region and beyond, welcoming families who value religious diversity, offering religious education and child care. CapitalRegionUU.org.
And we are back. As you know, we're talking to Dr. Lawrence Garbo, who is a medical oncologist and hematologist at New York Oncology Hematology, board certified in internal medicine, hematology, and medical oncology. And we are talking also to Jerry Ann Currier, who is the manager of New York Oncology Hematology's clinical research. Okay, so tell me about these studies. The phones are beginning to ring now, 1-800-348-2551. But what I need to know is, what would a typical trial look like?
So all studies are set up by phase, and clinical trials are anywhere from phase 1 to phase 4. Phase 4 are post-marketing studies, usually after a drug has already been FDA approved. Phase 1 trials only are first-in-human studies, so it's the first time a drug is being tested in humans outside of the lab. Those studies really only take about 30 participants, sometimes nationally. And those studies are trying to locate what is the best dose, as well as there's a dose escalation part, which means that we're trying to see and balance the efficacy of the drug and its ability to kill the cancer, as well as manage and get a profile of what the side effects are. Phase 2 drugs then open up to several hundred participants, and that is where we are comparing the new investigational drug or medicine against the standard therapy. And then into phase 3, now we're looking at several thousands of patients who we need to participate in order to see outcomes on that study. And that is using the new treatment, again, against the standard of care therapy. Those studies may be double blind, which is what you and Dr. Garbo spoke of earlier. At that point, once a study goes into phase 1 and we see FDA approval, that time range can be anywhere between 2 and 10 years. Yeah. And then once a study is listed with the FDA and they start their investigation, that period of time can be an additional 7 years.
So it can be 20 years.
Very lengthy time to see a new drug come to market.
Okay, we got a lot of people are starting to call now, 1-800-348-2551. Does it ever happen you start on stage 1 and you never phase 1 and you never get to phase 2 because you don't like what you're seeing?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, there are several new investigational agents that we see in clinical trial that never meet their endpoints. Many studies, the endpoint is either progression-free survival, meaning that we have extended the period of time that a patient's disease is worsening or progressing. Also, one of the endpoints is overall survival. Is this drug, how does it compare to the standard of treatment? Are we extending patients' lives?
Okay. Let's go to Mary in Newburgh. Okay, Mary, you're on.
Hi. I have a question about accessing clinical trials and knowing about which ones are good and where they are even. If you don't have a primary care physician who's really up to, you know, if you're living in a tiny town, and I have relatives that needs to get a clinical trial, I think, but the doctor there doesn't have any connections. So is there do you recommend going to another doctor, or is there a better way to get to clinical trial information? How do you do that? You know, it's so hard to stay on the phone and make all these calls yourself.
Sure. Mary, the first thing is to get in touch with an oncologist. So if your friend has only seen a primary care physician right now and she has a diagnosis of cancer, the first thing is to get her in for a consultation with an oncologist. Most oncologists, at least the ones I'm familiar with in my practice, very aware of the clinical trials that are out there. But unfortunately, we live in a time where most patients, their family members, need to advocate for themselves. And if your physician does not propose clinical trial as a treatment option for you, there are several things you can do. For New York Oncology, we have our own website and web page, and our clinical trials, our full list is located there page.
And what is it? What is the address?
NewYorkOncology.com.
Yeah.
All spelled out together, all lowercase, no spaces. But in addition to that, part of the clinical trials that we run are through the National Cancer Institute. And there is a database that they have that we recommend often to patients, and that is nci.gov/clinical trials. And you can go in there and you can search out your diagnosis, and it will tell you a little bit about what the eligibility criteria is for that study, because each protocol will have certain criteria that patients need to meet in order for them to go on study. But it'll also list the sites around the country that are actually participating in that particular trial and contact information.
Can I just ask one more question? Does this include any Canadian or any other outside of American places where the trial might be going on, or is it American specifically?
The NCI's website does, if it is an international trial, they will also list the other countries that are participating.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Bye.
1-800-348-2551. This is the kind of thing, if you listen to Medical Monday, that could really save your life if you do it right. And so it's a very important program. If you have a question, I want you to ask it now. Let's go to Mark in Balsam Spa. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how you doing? My mother was treated by Hematology Oncology Associates for 10 years. She had systemic lupus, and they gave her intravenous cyamedrol. I was wondering if there are any new clinical trials or studies that are going on that they're aware of participating in.
Well, for lupus per se, no. You know, we have treated patients with lupus in the past with solumedrol and other agents that are typically administered in medical oncology, hematology offices. But the hallmark of lupus treatment has swung from the hematology office to the rheumatology office at this point in time. And so most patients with active lupus, unless it's a drug that for some reason can't be administered by the rheumatologist, get their primary management through the rheumatologist and not the hematologist / medical oncologist.
Right, yeah. Dr. Hyla locally in Syracuse sent her to you guys, and you guys, the facility staff is wonderful. Unfortunately, she passed away last year after struggling with it for 28 years, and you guys were wonderful. I just want everybody to know what an amazing facility, and everybody from the receptionist to the doctors is wonderful. And I was just curious more from a medical perspective.
Well, it's great. It's great to hear, Mark. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate that. And I'm sorry about your loss. 1-800-348-2551. Is there any reason that somebody should be careful about going into a clinical trial? In other words, are there dangers in clinical trials?
Sure. You know, when we talk about phase one or even early phase two studies, we're looking at agents that are new to use in man. We don't always know if they will be efficacious for the particular tumor, and we're learning about their side effects. But today's standards of care were developed through the clinical trial mechanism, having gone through comparison and development in a similar manner. So side effects, yes. Efficacy, yes. Those both can be problems as one goes into a clinical trial. But at the same time, we do everything we can to try and assure that the drug is safe. And sometimes, particularly in early phase study, we're looking to develop efficaciousness.
Now, I don't want to start a whole big fight here, but so let's leave that for another time, folks. But do animals come first?
Yes.
And where are the animals? Do you use them in other places, or how does that work?
We actually do not conduct animal testing at our site, but there are large medical centers that do that lab testing initially on drugs.
And how I mean, it's always so interesting to me how much do we know from the animal studies? I mean, I've been reading about the Ebola thing right now, in which monkeys have been showing tremendous, longevity based on the anti-Ebola drugs. Now, do they often come over from animals to humans? I guess your word is efficaciously.
I'm not sure I understood your question.
Okay, so how often does it? If the monkeys test well, is it likely that the humans will test well also on this?
So usually, if a drug is found to be safe in animal testing, then we develop first in human testing to try and determine is it safe. And the initial testing in phase one studies is not looking at efficacy, but looking at safety.
Okay, let's go to Lee in Ulster. Okay, Lee, 1-800-348-2551. Lee, you're on.
Alan, I'm going to try and ask two questions. Question one, have these folks seen a change from that sort of 90s fantasy that we were going to find a cure in the tree canopy to more lab-based, synthetic, or genetically-based cure? It seems that that's what I'm reading, but I wanted to know if these folks felt that was the case. And my other question was, do they see 20 years as unduly long? I mean, is there any part of that process that they think could be curbed so that the length of time to get a drug on the market is not so long?
Great question. Great question. Okay, Jerry Ann, do you want to go first?
So I'm going to take your first question first, Lee, which I believe was, are we using synthetic drugs yet in treating cancer? And the answer to that question is it is starting to be developed. There is many drugs coming out. They're in a class of drug called biosimilars, where they are made synthetically to be identical to the chemotherapy, or with these new targeted therapies. A large class of those are of a drug called monoclonal antibodies, and they range anywhere from being fully human to components of them containing chimeric or mouse antibodies. So it is imperative that we try to find less expensive drugs and that we're able to synthetically manufacture them, and that's what the biosimilars will be doing.
Okay, and question two about the 20 years.
So 10 to 20 years indeed does sound like a long time. The FDA has recently developed a fast-track mechanism allowing for some drugs that look very promising and appear to be safe to be approved in a much shorter time after having much fewer patients involved in the clinical testing.
So give us an example of one that's taking the fast track.
Well, the new melanoma drug whose name...
Well, it's okay.
That just was released last week.
And I take it that people want to get in on clinical trials, sometimes anyway, in places where they are really either suffering or seeing very bad outcomes generally. So then they go to the clinical trial. Is that right?
Well, that's one way, but we try to offer clinical trials to any patient who presents with a disease for which we have an open trial. And we only open trials that we feel are of potential benefit and are likely to have long-term positive effects.
Anything else, Lee?
No, and I'm very grateful for your time. Thank you, folks.
Thank you, Lee. Bye. Okay, and now to Sherry. Sherry in Albany. Okay. Go ahead, Sherry.
Hey, Alan, how are you?
I'm good, Sherry.
Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I just pulled into Albany Medical Center from Saturdays. A friend of mine was diagnosed Let's see, I took her to the hospital on August 3rd, so I guess it was on Friday the 8th, with stage 4 breast cancer, and it's in the bone. She has DIC, so a little blood clot, and liver function is not great. They gave her 2 weeks to a month to live. At the moment, she is on day number 8 of her second round of oral chemo. And I'm just wondering if there are clinical trials that may, you know, that may be of a benefit at this late in the game. She had, no, by the way, no symptoms prior to, except for tired.
Sherry, that's a good question. The fact that she doesn't have symptoms is a good sign right now. As a stage 4 breast cancer patient, that does mean that her disease has metastasized to other organs outside of the breast. So it is definitely a serious situation for her. There are several trials that we currently are conducting at New York Oncology for patients who do have stage 4 breast cancer. Again, I would refer you to the website or the NCI.gov trial. And additionally, you know, I welcome phone calls. I'm sure my contact information should be posted at the end of this.
Well, let's do it. Let's do it now. Patients. Let's do it now.
Sure. Jerry, sure. I can be reached at Gerryann, GERRYANN.career.
GERR. I'm sorry.
Yes. Yep. G as in George.
Mm-hmm.
ERRYANN. .career, it's CURRIER, at usoncology.com. If your friend is already a patient of ours, we can do some pre-screening for you. If she is currently seeing another oncology practice, then we would ask to have her sent for consultation for an evaluation to see if there is a clinical trial that she would be able to participate in. But I would ask that you send me an email or reach out to me, and we can carry on this discussion to see if there's something we have locally for her.
Absolutely. I will have her son Ray do that. He's flying in from Colorado today. She's currently being treated at Albany Medical Center.
Thank you, Sherry. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, bye-bye. Let's go to Beth in Niskayuna. All right, Beth, you're on.
Hi, I'm calling about the animal trials. Isn't it that a drug isn't brought to market unless you can prove its side effects are better than other drugs? Am I correct on that? It has to have fewer side effects for it to come to market? Just to rephrase that?
Not always fewer side effects, but the combination of the side effect profile and the response are what are key. Sometimes you'll accept a little bit more in the way of side effects if it has a higher likelihood of inducing a response.
So that how is an animal going to express to, this is a concern, how is that animal going to be able to verbally express what's going on with it and to compare it to a human? How is that possible?
Well, the animal can't express it. And remember, we don't do animal trials in our practice. This is done at major centers in drug development. But you would look at organ toxicity as potential side effects related to the initial response in the animal.
So that animal could be... And then how long is that animal kept in that trial, since we live so much longer than the... I don't want to type the lines, but since we live so much longer... If you do a short trial, how many years is a trial? Is that animal kept in that condition because to verify those side effects?
Beth, the last thing I want to do is turn this into a show on animal testing.
Well, that was my last question because you mentioned it, so that was my last question.
Okay, well, you've asked it, and we thank you so much for your call. Bye. Let's go to, I don't know. It's one light on, but we'll have to see. Okay, in any case, what we're going to do now is take a short break, and we will be right back.
Support comes from Nathan LaTower Hospital, offering new urological treatments with urologist Dr. Paul Husson. NLH.org for more information. The Springfield Symphony Orchestra launching its 71st anniversary season with concerts from Beethoven to the Beatles. SpringfieldSymphony.org for tickets and info. The Urgent Care Centers of Middletown Medical, providing walk-in medical care with no appointment, daytime, evening, and weekend hours in Middletown, Ellenville, and now in Chester. MiddletownMedical.com. And Healthy Living Market and Cafe, a family-owned natural food market providing natural and organic foods. Now open 7 days a week at the Wilton Mall, HealthyLivingMarket.com. And Gordon Fire Equipment, offering fire extinguisher service and inspections to businesses and organizations in the Hudson Valley. Family-owned since 1956, GordonFire.com.
And we are back, and we're delighted to have you all with us. Dr. Garbo chairs the New York Oncology Hematology's Research Committee, where he oversees the region's largest clinical research trial operation over the past 20 years, pivotal role in FDA approval of 38 anti-cancer drugs. And Gerianne Currier is here with us today. She's manager of New York Oncology Hematology's clinical research, and they have the answers for many of the questions that you're going to ask. Let's go to Steve in Limass. Okay, Steve, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, everyone. Sure. So my question is basically about prevention. So Ashkenazi Jewish women who have the BRCA gene mutation, particularly for the development of ovarian cancer, by the time you become symptomatic, if you have ovarian cancer, you're already in serious trouble. So my question is, Would it make sense for people who have that history, particularly if there's a parent involved that also has the genetic mutation, to be, say, tested once every 3 months or once every month for CA125 levels? And then the second part of my question is how long the BRCA marker has been in existence for? How long have people known about it for?
So, I mean, testing in children of patients with the BRCA mutation and ovarian cancer, it's certainly reasonable. I'm not sure that every month is appropriate. Something a little less frequent than that, paying good attention, following up with a primary care provider. And how long has the BRCA mutation been known? I'm terrible remembering dates, but it's been present for many years, and we're learning more implications about it as we move forward.
So what are we learning?
We're learning that there are other diseases in which it may be associated, but the primary ones, the biggest risks, are certainly the Ashkenazi Jewish population, breast cancer, and ovarian cancer.
And so what is the relationship between the BRCA and the BRCA and ovarian cancer?
Well, it increases the risk of developing ovarian cancer in women who have the BRCA mutation.
Yeah. Steve, anything else on this?
Well, I guess one of the things that haunts me kind of is whether or not someone who is in that position and has developed ovarian cancer but was never tested for CA125 along the line should have been. You know, in other words, if a woman walked in that had a mother that died of breast cancer, that has the BRCA genetic mutation, should they have been tested for the genetic mutation in the first place, given family history? It's just ironic to me that every time you walk into a doctor's office, everyone, like, you have to write down every disease that everyone in your family has ever had, and no one seems to do anything with the information.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I feel that, too. Yeah.
At New York Oncology, we do, Steve, have a genetic counseling program. And as part of the consults that we do on women who are coming in with either breast cancer themselves or they're being referred because they have a close family member that's been diagnosed with breast cancer, those are some of the initial questions that we do ask. And again, those women, if it was identified that it seemed to be a family history, would be referred to genetic counseling. Part of that is doing this BRCA testing and additional testing.
But Stephen,
yeah, I was thinking more at the
GP,
level of
GP,
yearly gynecological visits, general practitioner visits. I'm thinking more for people, you know, like that are maybe in this position right now, that if someone were to say, hey, based on your family history, maybe we'll draw some blood and test CA-125 and see if there's an elevated level. You know, instead of becoming symptomatic a year from now and having it become stage 3 or 4.
Well, I think if there's a known BRCA mutation, then I think the question of hereditary risk in other family members needs to be addressed as well.
Hey, Steve, I'm so sorry. As usual, at the end of the program, everybody...
Yeah, I don't want to take up all your time. I appreciate your input, and thank you very much,
Steve,
guys.
It's good points. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Well, let's go to Anita. Anita in Waterville. Okay, you're on.
Hi, doctors. I was wondering about pancreatic cancer. My partner died 10 years ago of it, and the chemotherapy was brutal, and the cancer was very aggressive. And I just wondered what the new... if there are any new procedures.
That's a tough one, all right, doctor.
So there are multiple new chemotherapy combinations that have been used in treating pancreas cancer. They are with significant potential toxicity, and we do have new trials with tyrosine kinase inhibitors that we are about to open addressing this very question. We've participated in a variety of trials over the years for pancreas cancer and look forward to continuing that and hoping to find better treatments, both better tolerated and better response.
So how optimistic? Anita's question is great, something I think we all think about it. You know, the pancreas is basically a hidden organ, and it takes a long time to find it when it's got cancer. So are you optimistic, or are you saying, okay, we're going to test yet another drug, but do you think things are moving along?
Well, I think you're asking two different questions.
Yes, I am.
Okay, so one, I think you're asking a question is, should we be screening or evaluating patients more vigorously than we do now?
Right.
And the answer is probably only in patients with a strong family history, but also paying attention to patients who have nonspecific abdominal symptoms, looking to see if they may have a problem. As far as the treatments go...
What's a nonspecific?
Well, just someone comes in with a little discomfort in their belly. It's persistent.
Some weight loss.
It doesn't go away. Weight loss, nausea, fatigue, diarrhea, just any symptom related to the abdomen that can't be explained by some other etiology.
Okay.
And in the course of looking for that other etiology, you may be looking for pancreas cancer as well.
Mm-hmm. But how long before we develop a screening mechanism like rectal, in which we look at the pancreas to see whether or not we have that issue?
Well, the pancreas isn't an organ that you can routinely screen by an endoscopic evaluation. You can screen to see you can do an endoscopic procedure to look for dilated ducts that a mass in the pancreas may create as the tube, the duct that goes from the liver down to the small bowel gets impeded by a mass in the pancreas or by local lymph nodes. Ultrasounds and CAT scans, but CAT scans carry radiation risk.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Anita, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Right. Let's go to Carl in St. Albans. Okay, Carl, you're on.
Thank you. I was calling. My sister has been diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer 5 years ago, and then she had metastatic liver cancer. She's been going under surgical options and chemo for the liver cancer ever since. And recently she was on every 2 weeks for Avastin as a maintenance, but it looks like a tumor came back in the liver and possibly in the lungs. So I had two questions. One is if you have any information on the CD47, I think it is, study that's being done out of Stanford. And two, if any thoughts on the surgical approach for this late stage cancer tumors in both the lung and the liver. She's basically had cryoablation. She's had standard open procedures, and she's had microwave and MRI guided laser up to this point. So just surgical options and then the CD47 study.
Well, it sounds like your sister has been very aggressively treated and has done actually quite well if she's had metastatic disease for 5 years from colorectal cancer. I'm not sure how much more of a role there would be for surgery, particularly if she has disease at multiple sites. And really, physicians who are well-versed in her prior treatments would have a better opportunity to answer that question. I'm unfortunately not aware of the CD47 trial at Stanford.
Okay, thanks. I guess one of the questions on surgery, if I could just ask again. I've actually taken my sister all around the country. She lives in Kansas City, and I had her at Dana-Farber. I've had her at University of Kentucky and then Mayo Clinic. She doesn't have a team down in Kansas City. There's really no surgical cancer oncology groups, so she doesn't have a current surgical opinion, and I'm bringing her back to a hospital next week, but I was kind of looking for some advice in advance of that because she currently doesn't have anybody but an oncologist opinion. So,
I think finding a facility that is convenient for you that has a good surgical oncology department would be appropriate, and I really don't know the lay of the land near Kansas City.
Okay. All right. Thank,
call.
You,
thank you for your good call. The telephone number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You have a very good chance of getting in right now. We've got Lewis from Woodstock, and then you would be up next. Again, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Lewis. All right, Lewis, you're on.
Oh, you can hear me, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I understand that when you have a breast cancer, like slow killing, they look at your genome or the gene of the cancer, and they look for 300 different little markers on that gene to decide how they're going to treat it. You know about that?
Yes.
Okay. So do they do that for prostate cancer?
I'm not aware of a similar procedure for prostate cancer at the present time.
Do you think that looking at the prostate cancer biopsy, gene, would show anything as far as like how to treat it? Or you just said you don't know?
No, I'm not aware of any active protocol for that at the present time.
Okay, here's a question. When they give you the hormone ablation, which means they stop the testosterone in the testes and the adrenal glands and the fat tissues and so forth, combination hormone thing, for prostate cancer. When they completely stop the testosterone and drop it down to practically nothing, what does that do to the prostate cancer tumor in the prostate?
Well, it's intended to shrink that, and if we get lucky, make that disappear.
So you're saying that the cancer cells in the prostate during this ablation should die?
That is our goal.
With prostate cancer, it's very much you want to keep the testosterone low, level low. It's a contributing factor. And similar to breast cancer, you're looking at whether or not that breast cancer is estrogen receptor positive, progesterone receptor positive. These are hormones that our body normally produces actually, if you continue to give those hormones, can make your tumor grow.
Lewis,
so the goal is to suppress those hormones.
I know you'd like to continue it, but so would the other four people behind you. Thank you, Lewis, for calling.
Yeah, wait a minute. Listen, there's also a guy out in Michigan at a university there that has a test where he tests the urine under certain circumstances. He can find cells in that urine that will say, if there's cancer anywhere in the body, and by checking the genes on it, they can find out where those cancers are.
Okay, so your question is?
Question is, did you ever hear about that stuff? Because it's actually out there and available right now, but the test costs $2,000 and it's not covered by any insurance.
Okay, listen, we got to go, Lewis. Thank you very much for that information. We'll look it up. Okay, let's go to Ollie in Lenox. Ollie, you're on.
Yeah, thanks. I find the discussion of treatment in late-stage cancers to be very depressing because generally things don't work very well.
Indeed.
However, recently there have been a couple of immune therapies. Ipilimumab or Yervoy has been approved, and there have been some extremely exciting trials with a PD-1 antibody And I'm wondering if you can just comment on your degree of optimism for this new approach in therapy.
Ollie's question, doctor.
So we've participated in, and continue to participate in many of these trials. We're very enthusiastic about trials with PD-1 and PD-L1 antibodies and that approach to immunotherapy.
What are they? I'm sorry, I'm ignorant.
Targeted therapies.
They're targeted therapies.
Targeted therapies. Okay.
So I just have a comment that I think will tie into Lewis's last caller's question regarding genome and the human genome mapping, testing, and that kind of thing. There are several companies nationwide that are have developed genetic assays where they're able to test a piece of your tumor tissue and tell you if it has any of these biomarkers or these mutations are identified. Again, that helps your physician then be able to find a targeted therapy drug that can shut down the overproduction or that mutation and inevitably help to either decrease your cancer, decrease the recurrence rate, or how quickly your cancer comes back. So there are several companies out there who, again, are doing those genetic assays, and we do have several studies targeting them.
Okay. Thank you, Ollie. And let's go to Jane, June in Albany. Okay, June.
Yes, hi. I'll be brief. I am calling regarding a previous caller's question as to why the CA-125 wasn't routinely tested for or screened for. I'm an 11-year ovarian cancer survivor. I was treated at NYOH, and they did screen for that, and the levels were not elevated, and they are not always elevated. That is not an accurate test, because they then proceeded to remove an 11-centimeter tumor from inside of me, and I was told that the reason for the test was that if it was indeed elevated, then afterwards, as you were undergoing various kinds of treatments, they would regularly monitor it to see if it was decreasing, and that would help them assess how well the treatment was proceeding. So I just wanted to pass that on to the previous caller. That's
very helpful. Thank you.
Not something that you want to screen for regularly because it really doesn't prove anything.
June, very helpful. Thank you very much. Doctor,
you're welcome.
So there are multiple tumor markers available, but none of them are perfect. They're helpful when they're abnormal when tumor is present, improve when tumor is treated, and then start to rise, suggesting there may be new tumor activity. Occasionally, it can be very frustrating with a rising tumor marker and the inability to find where the active cancer is in the patient.
And let's go to Nick in Castleton, Vermont. Nick, you're on. Keep it short. We're almost out of time.
Thank you. Yes, many anti-establishment aging hippies in my family, and one of them is very anti-medical establishment and has her daughter no longer getting chemo for uterine cancer, and they are doing liquid vegetable and fruit mixes followed by coffee enemas, this kind of fringe treatment.
Got it, Nick. So
how common is it, and is it ever successful?
So these alternative therapies are not ones that have known proven benefit in good peer-reviewed medical literature, unfortunately.
And in fact, Nick, I knew somebody who I loved who died, but who used mistletoe therapy. I think you got it right. Thank you, Nick.
I also think important to note that several alternative therapies, something that may seem rather benign, can interact with the different chemotherapies. And if you are on a clinical study, may not be allowed for you to take while you are on the investigational agent. So it's important that if you are choosing to use alternative therapies, herbals, St. John's wort, etc., that you disclose that to your doctor.
And not only for clinical trials, but also for standard chemotherapy as well.
Okay. A big apology to Diane in Chatham because we are out of time. Diane, I hope you get in there a little earlier the next time and we'll try to get you in. We are out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in. Apologize to Diane. I'd also like to thank Dr. Lawrence Garbo and Jerry Ann Currier for joining us today. Support for the Medical Monday comes from Toprosyn, natural medicine formula creams designed to heal muscles, joints, nerves, and skin conditions, including shingles and eczema. Toprosyn.com. And thanks again for joining us today on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Beloy. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.